Can you remember your first day at school? I was terrible starting, wasn't it? I mean, I could spot the playground, but you really didn't know where anything was. Which was my classroom? Where was the dining room? I didn't know anyone. Just my brother, but he was an older brother, 3 years older, and he disappeared. Or the first day at uni, and you're looking around college or checking out the halls of residence, and you don't know a soul. Or maybe the first day in the team dressing room and you're new to the side. Or your first day in the new job and you shuffle into the office and you don't even know where your desk is. Some people just barge through the door as if they've always been there and are completely at home from the first moment, aren't they? But most of us, I suspect, act much more unsure of ourselves. It's not just getting to know names, but there are several other questions tumbling around in our minds. How do I fit in? How do things work here? What are the values? How do I get on? Well, I don't think those questions are far from the disciples' mind at the beginning of chapter 18. Johnny reminded us last week that at the end of the previous chapter, Jesus had been talking of the kings of the earth and how their children are treated. And as they join up the dots, it's as if the disciples realize he's implying they are children of his kingdom, the kingdom of heaven. Well, if that's the case, how do things work in this new kingdom? And Jesus' answers were disturbing then, and they're still radical now. If church, if the All Souls family is meant to be some kind of outpost of trailer for the kingdom of heaven, have we just taken a familiar set of values and ways of relating and transferred them across with us and stuck a new label on them, or do we see signs of something as radically different as Jesus spells out here? I'll be honest, it's been an uncomfortable week chewing over Jesus' words and seeing how they applied to me and how they applied to us as a church family. Here's the first thing that struck me, that opening paragraph, what I've called becoming a little one. You see, the disciples start to explore, verse 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? You know, who counts around here? Who matters? Now, they're important questions when you're new somewhere. And Jesus doesn't give them a straight answer. At least, he doesn't name names. Instead, verse 2, he called a little child to him and placed the child among them. And you see what's happened immediately? I mean, I don't know how big the crowd was, but there was a fair crowd. And now the spotlight's not on them. It's not on Jesus even. It's on this little child in the middle of them. And he said, truly, I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, when he talks about little children, don't think of some precocious, lippy child armed with a full awareness of all their rights and liberties. I mean, they do exist. They're unthinkable in some parts of the world. They're unthinkable probably to some generations. I'm old enough to have had parents who would quote that old saying to me about little children should be seen and not heard. I don't recall living it terribly well. I don't really recall them enforcing it terribly much, but they knew it, they said it. You know what it means? It's really saying, listen, child, remember your place, and your place when there are grown-ups around is you don't count. He called a little child to him, and the child came, because that's what children were meant to do, so he did it. And the disciples were concerned about rank and status, but children had none. They were nobodies. They had to be looked after, not looked up to. I mean, Jesus is very subversive. The disciples come in with their entitled ideas, you know, full of who matters and what counts and wondering if there's a fast-track route to the top. And Jesus says, unless you change, you won't even enter. Unless you change, you won't even enter the kingdom of heaven. He probably needs to say the same to many of us when we bring our sense of self-importance to church. The sense that we matter, that we're the ones who count. And Jesus does not ask us to be childish, but he does ask us to take the status of a little one. See verse 4? Therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. But it's humbling, isn't it, to see yourself as a nobody? Several times across my ministry, people have told me how responsible and important a job they hold Monday to Friday. You know, the millions of pounds or dozens of staff they manage. And then when they come to the punchline of what they're saying to me, they say, the trouble is, the church thinks I'm only good for pouring the tea. And there are times when we need to hold our hands up and say, yeah, you're right, we are poor at mobilizing people well, apologies. But sometimes they need to hear Jesus. When it's a case of only willing to serve on their terms, of not wanting to be treated like everybody else as if they're just an average Christian. Unless you change and become like little children, even the Son of Man, Jesus said, and you couldn't have a more responsible and important job than the Son of Man. I mean, the millions and the dozens of staff fade into insignificance compared with the responsibilities he had. Even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many, the kind of service that didn't mean you could stand on any dignity. Or look at this, look at verse 5. And whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And just as my heart is sinking, Jesus tells me the value of the nobody, the little one. They're a Jesus person. And we've seen the opposite of this kind of welcome, haven't we? You try to talk with someone and their eyes are on permanent patrol, looking for someone much more worthwhile their time chatting to. We've probably done it ourselves. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. Jesus draws alongside, identifies with the little one. You're welcoming me. A friend was telling me this week of their time in another country where to become a Christian was in effect to declare yourself a fool or an outcast, where to go to church was to sit with the vulnerable, where there were no middle-class Christians. And imagine her first visit to All Souls. The sense of wonder when she realized that was a lawyer, a banker, a judge, a teacher, a doctor. And then realized how much harder here to live this lesson. Becoming a little one, losing my self-importance, and yet discovering the value of a little one. Well, if that's where this chapter starts off, where it goes next is something like this, what I've called stumbling a little one. And let me explain. Let me give you the background to this paragraph, because it's all about stumbling blocks. And two very similar Greek words, one skandalizo, to cause to stumble. And that's there in verses 6 and 8 and 9. And another very close word, scandalon, to tempt to stumble, to tempt someone to stumble. And that occurs three times in verse 7. So you see, there are these real stumbling blocks, and then there are the little ones, not children, but believers, verse 6, those who believe in me. Insignificant believers, though. Ones it's too easy to think don't matter, too easy to be careless about and think, well, it's only them. So the disciples are vulnerable. The stumbling blocks are real, both in the discipleship group, verses 6 and 7, and within ourselves personally, verses 8 and 9, and the dangers are huge. So with that as the background, come and look at the detail. See verse 6? If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it will be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. Well, what kind of stumbling is Jesus imagining? Church abuse? Well, we've seen in recent months how subtle and manipulative, as well as how brutal that can be, and how close to home it comes too. That can't possibly escape this. But it's got to be wider. Church abuse, yes. False teaching that leads to false believing and false living. Well, there are battles in so many churches and denominations to try and avoid that danger. Only this weekend, some Anglican Christians in New Zealand formed their own grouping for that reason and at considerable cost to themselves. And I was shown a letter a vicar has sent to his bishop explaining why he must now be in broken partnership with the bishop and the diocese because they'd made a senior appointment and reaffirmed it of someone who was teaching and living brazenly against Scripture. Yeah, I guess that kind of false teaching too, church abuse, false teaching, but now it can get smaller than that. My own careless behavior that leads or encourages others into sin by teaching or modeling it. You know, if she can do it, it must be okay. And it's no laughing matter. If I'm the one causing the offense, a quick and guaranteed drowning would be a better future for me than what is coming. Verse 7. Woe to the world because of the things that cause people to stumble. See, Jesus is not in dreamland. As if we could create a temptation-free zone. There's always the world outside to tempt me to lust and to greed and siren voices enticing me to one kind of idolatry or another. Such things must come, he goes on. But woe to the person through whom they come. Don't you be the one to stumble a fellow believer, however insignificant. Don't hide behind what the world does to duck responsibility. Don't join the kind of blame generation that has to blame someone for almost anything, but it's always someone else. Jesus faces us with the times when we need to own our own responsibilities. This is a real wake-up call, and Jesus has got no room for the indifferent disciple who thinks church is just for turning up. It matters what you and I believe, and it matters how you and I live. It can be massively damaging to others and hugely dangerous for us to step into or drift into the wrong place here. Now, this is the language of the extremist that Jesus speaks. But notice, the violence is to ourselves, not to others. It's for our protection, not for our destruction. If, verse 8, if your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, so before I'm in danger of causing others to stumble too, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life maimed or crippled than to have two hands and two feet and be thrown into eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into the fire of hell. And you say, Hugh, is that picture language or should we take it literally? Well, I believe Jesus is painting a picture here. He's not intending me to pick up a knife and start crude surgery on myself, but it's a horrifying picture. And the horror is real. Our son Mark, when he was in his early 20s, wanted to join the army, went to a selection conference for it. It was at the height of the Afghan war, and British soldiers were in Helmand province fighting fiercely, and deaths were being reported any day, virtually every day. I think almost any parent joining the dots for a son would be thinking, going into the army will lead to dead in Helmand sooner or later. What was actually worse in my mind, I think, was the endless soldiers who'd lost limbs, struggling to recover. And for all the remarkable prosthetic limbs we have, there was no avoiding the stumps that once were arms and legs. And the thought of my Mark battling that, it was painful just to watch, and nearly every night the news had some story like that. In fact, there were times I couldn't watch, never mind think of inflicting that damage on myself. And yet Jesus is telling me that unthinkable damage is better than the fires of hell. What does that tell me about hell? And what fools we are when we live carelessly and think we know better than Jesus about hell. I mean, you can't get much more stupid than that, can you? To imagine you are a better expert on the afterlife than Jesus. Grow up. To live today speeding blindly into a terrible tomorrow. Yes, there's a ruthlessness to what Jesus says, an urgency to his wake-up call, and I, for one, need it. I caught myself the other day, savoring what I knew was wrong, and these words were still in my mind somewhere, and I realized that terrible though this tomorrow is, it did seem very far away compared with the fun of today. And I think my brain, in a scrambled way, was thinking, have the fun, move on, you can avoid the hell. Hell always will seem too remote a danger for many until the reality hits. A friend of mine took these words far better than I did. He picked up on their ruthlessness. He cut himself off from the internet. He sold his iPhone, got the most basic of mobiles to protect himself from the porn he was starting to watch online. Yeah, as I've chosen over these words this week, I've realized a big difference between Jesus and me. The seriousness of sin and the reality of hell are so much greater for him. We're far apart. He can't stand the casual way I can think of sin. You know, it won't really matter. It's just this once. Everyone does it. Put those ideas alongside this paragraph from Jesus. His kingdom takes sin seriously. His kingdom's horrified when a little one is caused to stumble. It would never dismiss that with an indifferent shrug. But we? Is that the way we think and live? Is that the feel all souls gives? Becoming a little one. Essential to the kingdom. Stumbling a little one. Anathema to the kingdom. So lastly, valuing a little one. See verses 10 to 14. Look at verse 10. See that you do not despise one of these little ones. I mean, that's the theme all the way through, and it's very clear that God doesn't. And the emphasis in the paragraph is on the value of even one of these little ones, these insignificant believers. As verse 10 goes on, you get the nearest the Bible comes to the idea of guardian angels. And there's plenty of myth, plenty of fantasy talk spoken about guardian angels, but here's a truth. See, look at verse 10. For I tell you that their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father in heaven. What's he talking about? Well, it was hard to get an appointment with the king. I mean, it's always hard to get an appointment with a king, isn't it? And especially if you're an insignificant little one. But in the heavenly throne room, they have 24/7 FaceTime with the Father. That's how our heavenly Father values little ones. Or put it this way, verse 12. See, what do you think? If a man owns 100 sheep and one of them wanders away, will he not leave the 99 on the hills and go to look for the one that wandered off? And if he finds it, truly I tell you, he's happier about that one sheep than about the 99 that did not wander off. In the same way, your Father in heaven is not willing that any one of these little ones should perish. That's how our Heavenly Father values little ones. And it isn't natural. I mean, the Gospel of Thomas, one of those books that was written a little later than New Testament times, it completely misses the point and reverses it. In fact, it makes the sheep that wandered off the largest and the one the shepherd loves more than the other 99. But the whole point is that little ones are insignificant. And would anyone notice if they just wandered off? Well, Father would. Rabbinical teaching of the day was happy with the righteous, but if someone wandered, the finger started wagging in judgment, the Father starts looking to rescue. What do you think? I've had people come in management consultant mode, spreadsheets out, mentally at any rate, doing an efficiency review and querying the point and wisdom of leaving the 99. Well, put your spreadsheets and efficiency drives away and see what's really being said. This is the value of the little one. Do not despise the little one. Don't listen to the voice that says, he's not worth the effort. She's not worth the trouble. You've got better things to do with your time. It's only one. There are more important people to give your energies to. Who's going to notice? Have you heard those voices? Have you spoken those voices? Well, remember, each little one with an angel in 24/7 FaceTime with Father in heaven. Everyone counts with him. Norman is a very lucky sheep. I mean, not just because he featured on Have I Got News For You this week, but he was at the center of one of the most treacly sentimental stories of recent days. Norman was the youngest of triplets, but his mother rejected him. And his owner, Melanie McLean, hand-reared him. He was born back in April, but last month he was sold at a sheep market in the Outer Hebrides. Only 3 weeks later, Melanie was so heartbroken at having lost little Norman, she decided she wanted him back. And so she travelled 270 miles, arrived at a farm, was taken to a field where Norman was with 700 other sheep. She put on a pink cap she always wore outdoors on her farm, and she spotted Norman, and she called, and Norman recognized her, and she said, ran like a bullet towards her. I've never seen a lamb run that fast. And Norman is now back home and chilled, and Melanie McLean is euphoric. She's happy over the one sheep, the wanderer she got back. Now, more seriously, I was talking last week with a good friend who runs a string of care homes. I was kind of weighing up whether to book a place on an early bird discount, you know. And as we were chatting about it and what was involved in running these care homes, we were talking about staffing. And he said to me, I mean, it surprised me. He said, yeah, nurses. He said, well, we often had nurses in, but nurses are always putting people in groups. And so we had endless rounds. You know, you'd have the doctors round, and then you'd have the medicines round, then you'd have the bloods round, then you'd have the meal rounds. Said, now we've got companions, and they have a small ratio of residents to look after, but we've also got technology that monitors all the residents, so we can see if they haven't drunk enough water today and tip the companion off to go there and encourage them to do so. It's all based on much more individual care. Everyone counts. Do not despise one of these little ones. Do we give little ones, insignificant believers, do we give them the value the kingdom of heaven gives them? I don't know what the Lord is kind of tapping you on the shoulder about this morning. There'll be a life group leader here, and you've noticed someone slipping away, not really turning up. You've thought about sending a text or giving them a ring. You just haven't done it yet. That name will be coming into your mind. Or you're just an individual Christian friend, but and you've spotted a friend heading down the wrong path, and you've thought about it. You've even talked it over with someone else, but you've never faced them with their wandering. And the Lord's saying, don't despise the little ones. And there'll be many of us, and for us it's maybe personal wandering and causing others to stumble, encouraging them to sin, a personal failing that brings temptation to others. The colleague at work you didn't even realize knew you were a Christian, but they do, and they've been watching, and they'll follow your example. You know, if he does it, then it must be okay. And kingdom living means eternity shapes today's lifestyle. God will be saying, don't despise the little ones. And all the time Jesus is speaking, you think that child is standing rather sheepishly there in the middle of us. And it's a reminder to all of us, before we patronize little ones, remember, becoming one myself is the entry point to the kingdom. Losing that self-importance, which seems so natural to so many of us, and taking on the God-given value of a little one. Dependent, insignificant, priceless to Father and to Jesus the King. So why don't we start there? Maybe personally, maybe as a church, we need to say sorry. There are things we need to put off. And we need to say thank you. And there's a value we need to put on. The value of a little one. So let's be still. Let's be quiet for a few moments. Let those names be whispered into our mind. Let those failings and wanderings of our own be made clear to us. Let that humbling of ourselves be our start point. This last song is any and every Christian story. You can't say better of yourself than this. There's nothing more important about you than to be able to say this: I was lost, but Jesus found me. Found the sheep that went astray, raised me up, and gently led me back into the narrow way. So let's stand and sing our story.